Good afternoon, everyone. Patrick Brenner here, president of the Southwest Public Policy Institute. You can tell that we're getting serious because we've invested in some new podcasting equipment. I picked up a microphone and a boom, and I'm joined today by our very own vice president of research, Mr. D. Dowd Muska. Thanks for joining us, Dowd. It's good to have you here again. We're on episode 11 of SPPI TV, Powering the Future. But before we get started with our special guests today, we ran a poll on Twitter to find out exactly how we can incorporate more history and to get everybody that listens to our podcast to take us not less seriously, but to understand that we've got a little bit of personality here too. So we ran a poll. We asked what kind of hat you'd like me to wear for this episode, and I think we're going to keep doing that. Folks, if you don't know me, you know that I love history. I used to be in the living history space and in the reenacting space, and I've collected an obscene number of historical headgear over the years. And we ran a poll. It was either 1776 cocked hat or 1851 shako. So everybody chose the 1851 shako. I picked this guy up from a good friend of mine. His name is Larry Pope. He actually used to be the site manager at Fort Stanton here in New Mexico, which was originally founded in 1855. It was captured by the Confederates during the Confederate invasion of New Mexico, or the New Mexico Territory at the time. And he used to be the site manager there, and he had an opportunity to actually take apart an original. It was in really bad shape. I don't consider it a bad move on his part to have taken it apart to inspect the original construction techniques. And then he built a bunch of these hats as we were getting ready to portray the Utah War event, which was, it ended up getting canceled, but we created dozens of these shakos for reenactors across the country to portray the U.S. infantry as it would have existed in the late 1850s. Anyway, into today's episode, we have our very special guest today, Larry Behrens. Larry Behrens is the Director of Communications at Power the Future. Dowd and Larry, we're here today to talk about exactly what the future looks like in terms of energy production, and to do a little bit of a deep dive back on an old report that we published in November of 2022, our first white paper at the Southwest Public Policy Institute that was authored by Dowd Muska, A Bright Shining Disappointment. We got a lot of really great traction at the time. It was all about solar photovoltaics failure in the American Southwest. So Dowd and Larry, I'm going to have you guys take it away.
Great, Mr. President. You look divine. Some might use other adjectives, but Patrick and I are a little bit of one of the reasons we work so well together is because we're history buffs. And folks, if you want to go to our website, click on updates. I recently wrote a piece on the 50th anniversary of the end of Project Plowshare, which relates to our discussion today. That was an attempt to use peaceful nuclear explosions to achieve civil engineering projects, including the stimulation of oil and gas. And the last explosion, nuclear explosion, here in America, in Colorado, for Project Plowshare was 50 years ago. I believe it was on May 18th. So we were pretty much the only organization in America that noted that the passing of Project Plowshare, the 50th anniversary. Larry, thank you for joining us today. I want to, boy, I'm really tempted to start with John Kerry because I John Kerry is really one of the most loathsome human beings alive. But Patrick made a good point about our solar paper. And of course, here in the West, you're talking about the plains, the central part of the country with the wind, and then solar in the Southwest. We are being told more and more that the green energy transition is underway and everything is wonderful. And we're going to receive our fuel for our electrical plants for free. Energy Information Administration, a group that compiles data on, it's a federal agency. I don't find them very useful when they're making projections because I think a lot of politics infects what they do, but they're great at just tracking data. Last week, this is just a couple days ago. This must have been either Monday or Tuesday. In nominal terms, the average monthly electricity bill for residential customers in the United States, Joe average, Jane average, increased 13%. From 2021 to 2022. When you adjusted for inflation, that was a 5% growth in the price of a homeowner's electricity. That was the largest single year growth in the price of electricity for homeowners since the Energy Administration, Energy Information Administration began tracking these data in 1984. Larry from Power of the Future, if solar is free, sunshine is free, if wind is free, why are our electricity rates going up in America?
Hey, Dad, it's so great to talk with you. And your point is exactly the right one. And I'll throw another on top of it. You know, the U.S. Census Bureau has something that I recently discovered. It's called the Pulse Survey. And I think they've been doing it for a number of years as well. And they essentially look at what Americans are going through in life. And one of the things they look at is energy bills. And what they found was within the last year or two, 23% of all of the United States, everyone in the United States, 23% has had trouble paying their whole energy bill within the last 12 months. And so that's, you know, nearly one out of every four houses. You know, look around your neighborhood. They're having trouble paying their energy utilities, whether that's for heating, whether that's for keeping the home cool in the summer, or their gas bill, all of those things, gas for their car, obviously, all of those things. And so the price increases are absolutely real. As much as, you know, purveyors of solar and wind want to deny that, it absolutely is. And so let's just take a look at this. And I know your work pointed it out as well, but I mean, ballpark, you're looking at, if you want to build a solar farm or a wind farm, you're looking at, you know, a 30% tax credit, which is ginormous. It is something that I don't know what other industry gets that kind of break. And that's before we even talk about the different types of, you know, subsidies and cash opportunities on the state level that are out there. And you're absolutely right. If these technologies were so effective, they would have caught on by now. We have this, you know, and I know you guys love history. Let me throw a little history lesson as well. You know, back in 2009, we had a stimulus package because the economy is cratering, and there was $90 billion of that stimulus package that was made for, you guessed it, green technologies. And it was supposed to usher in this era of, hey, we're going to have all these green jobs, we're going to make this transition, this $90 billion is going to get it done, and we're going to put someone in the administration in charge of it by the name of Vice President Joe Biden. Well, we all know what happened. Part of that money went to Solyndra. We did not have this revolution. We are still using these ineffective is the only way to describe it, devices to capture the wind and the sun, and they work only intermittently. When they do work, they never, and the media never follows up on, you know, when we, there's that nice ribbon cutting and they say, here's the capacity. They don't talk about how often any type of facility actually meets that capacity. All they talk about is just their nice pictures and everything that's happened to destroy the jobs that were there before. It was something that is, you know, I know spreading all out in New Mexico. It's spreading all out in the United States, except for those states that have put a stop to it. And so I know that's a rambling answer, but the bottom line is, the solar industry and the wind industry would not be able to stand on a fair fight against any of our traditional energy sources. And the government knows that, so they keep pushing it. And when you start to see, you know, the money lining some pockets of some pretty big campaign donors, then you really start to understand why.
Absolutely. And I think that in terms of, we can even go further into history. I dug up a column I wrote about 10 years ago when I was back east, and I looked at, again, EIA data. So this is the federal government's data, nothing I made up, and then adjusted for inflation. Most of certainly the post-war era, post-World War II era for our younger people. I'm old enough that when I say post-war, I still mean post-World War II. 1985 residential costs for adjusted for inflation, 15.9 cents a kilowatt hour. 1990, 13.9 cents. 1995, 12.8. You're starting to see a downward trend. 2000, 11.1 cents per kilowatt hour. Even into the early 2000s, we were seeing inflation adjusted price for residential consumers going down. We're seeing a complete reversal of that. And why this isn't on the front page of newspapers everywhere is beyond me. But Larry, I think it's important for us to make a distinction. And you mentioned the subsidies, and Solyndra is a wonderful example. And there's so many more. I think the hydrogen hub budding boondoggle out here in the West, although it's also, I guess they're going to be doing them other parts of the country too. Larry, talk about the fact that you're paying more as an electricity customer, as a ratepayer. That is hiding how you're paying in other ways. So to the extent that you're paying for the subsidies more indirectly, and some of this money, of course, is funded at the federal level where we're borrowing money, so you're going to be paying the interest on that borrowed money to subsidize green power. As angry as people can be about their bill, we most of us get it electronically now, you're paying for the green transition in many hidden ways as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I would argue you're paying for it in inflation, right? You're paying for a government that is eroding the foundation of our energy industry here in the United States, and that is bearing a cost in so many ways. Yeah, it makes the things go up at the grocery store when the cost of diesel gasoline goes higher. It makes a lot of sense, but for some reason, yeah, it doesn't meet that coverage. But when we look at, you know, the costs that go into it, let's just say all things are equal, which, well, obviously we know they're not, but let's say all things are equal, that a kilowatt hour is a kilowatt hour is a kilowatt hour, regardless of how it's produced. Well, you have to take a look at, okay, if we're going to switch where that energy is produced from a power station in the northwest part of a state down to a wind farm in the central part of the state, well, what do you have to do? You have to build new power lines, new wires, new ways to transfer that energy, moving in and out of the state, in and out of the areas it needs to be, so that the grid stays balanced. And all of that requires infrastructure. It requires land acquisition. It requires a whole bunch of initial capital investment. And again, even if all kilowatt hours were created equal in terms of price, there would be an increase on that price because you are building new infrastructure for it. So for proponents of it to say, we're going to be able to do this without disrupting your bill, it's a genuine lie on the face of it, because they are having to build new infrastructure. Then you get to the argument of, well, the infrastructure you're building is not reliable power. We've seen that in Texas. We've seen it in California. It just doesn't work when the sun doesn't shine and the wind doesn't blow. And lo and behold, most Americans, myself included, have become addicted to using electricity all day, every day. And so until the government can mandate to get rid of this thing called night, until the government can mandate to get rid of this thing called still breezy days, then you know what? We're not going to be able to rely on these sources that they are forcing us upon because of it. Let's just be honest. It's an ideology. It has nothing to do with a science-based or practicality-based policy. It has everything to do with, well, they want to undermine their political opponents because they see their political opponents come from certain industries. So what do they start to do? They start to work really hard to undermine those industries, and they don't really care what it does to the workers in the process. They've gone from feigning care, saying we'll throw a few tax dollars at you, now to just straight out belligerence, just laughing it off. Right, when people lose their jobs because maybe the people don't vote the way that someone in Washington wants them to do. So there's really no desire to help those who are having their lives upended by all this. I mean, imagine the situation you're in if you're one of those folks that has lost a job and you've seen prices on everything go through the roof over the last 2 years. You know, I'm old enough to remember when one party said they cared about poor people, and we've completely seen that turned on its head over the last 2 years. And so when we mess with something as foundational as energy in our country, especially when we didn't need to, we start to see things that, if you mess with the underlying body, then you're going to see symptoms in places that you didn't expect. And obviously people's home electric bills is one symptom, but there are just many, many more.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned the transmission lines, Larry, because the comeback from our green friends often is, oh, well, we're not seeing the savings yet because we haven't built the infrastructure, and we need to take the resources, the turbines and the solar panels, from where the energy is created to where the people are. And so this is just going to be a one-time deal. There are problems with that line, but the other argument that's ignored in that, and I've been tracking some of these transmission projects, whether it's taking power from Wyoming and sending it down to Southern California, or taking power from the plains, you know, eastern New Mexico, Texas, and sending that, the SunZia line, into Arizona and California. There's a very big environmental footprint for the turbines, the solar panels, and of course the transmission lines as well. The great Thomas Sowell, the great economist that so many of us on the free market side like, respect so much, says, you know, there's no such thing as a solution. There's only trade-offs. That's the problem of scarcity and having to perfection doesn't descend from the heavens. You have to make a choice, and every time you make a choice, you're denying something else and you're inducing a new cost. Whether it's the desert tortoise, whether it's the desert sage grouse, whether it's the dune sagebrush lizard, I do think there's a lot of dishonesty on the part of a lot of the greenie activists, because they're pushing for these projects, they're pushing for the energy transition, and then when it comes time to build the infrastructure, they're fighting it. So I call it the greenie bait and switch. I'm sure you fought many of those battles as well. It's a serious problem if we're going to make the energy transition.
Yeah, we absolutely see it everywhere, you know, and it bleeds into the hypocrisy too, right? I know companies in New Mexico. I think a company had to pay the largest settlement ever for killing bald eagles, $2 million in New Mexico. And so now what do? They just, whenever someone petitions for a wind farm, the Biden administration has allowed them to essentially buy into how many birds they're going to kill whenever they want to build the wind farm. And so, and again, environmentalists, you know, to one in there don't have any problem of it, but where we see this most is electric cars, right? They demand that we're going to be forced on this transition to all by electric vehicles. I know a lot of governors and a lot of states have said by such and such date, because it's always arbitrary and it's always different, we're going to have X amount of cars sold in our state be electric vehicle. I think California is trying to go all electric by 2035, 2040, as far as vehicle sales. Well, they know that it takes 6 times the metal to build an electric vehicle that it does an internal combustion vehicle. And they know that metal has to come out of the ground. And yet we see them fighting mining operations, particularly in Alaska, to say, no, you can't do that. And so it's absolutely right. They force you to use these products, then they don't let you get the materials to build those products. And it just goes down to, again, they are meddling in the free market as they have always done. And it's interesting that, you know, we'll say what you will about Apple. I know they're not a shining great example of capitalism in a lot of ways, but no one had to force me to buy an iPhone. I saw people using it. I thought it was a better product. And so I went ahead and bought it. And yet that hasn't happened yet, right? With the solar panels, with the windmills, with the electric cars, they have not been able to compete in a strictly fair market where Americans have the choice of what they're going to do. So what do they do now? They start taking away the choice. And it is something that, okay, if you want to do it at my kid's school lunch, that really bothers me, but I don't eat my kid's school lunch. And so throw some more lettuce at them. But when they start looking at, oh, we're going to make you go down this road for your electricity that is required in a lot of cases, let's be upfront, it's required for survival in the winter, in the summer. If our homes didn't have electricity, it would turn into an uncomfortable, life-threatening situation for many, many Americans right away. And so they're going to take those things that is critical to our homes and start putting it on a platform of intermittency and unreliability. And oh yeah, you'll pay a premium to do it as well. And that's why it hasn't been adopted by the American consumer by and large, because it has a whole lot of warts with it. Again, not to, you know, say that in the future some kiddo in a garage is not going to come up with a great idea. American innovation has always turned out great ideas, but these ideas and these four solutions are not it.
Yeah, Larry, thanks for the shout out to the pebble mine up in Alaska, because I've been following that one for years, and I actually stopped buying clothes from a certain clothing retailer because they were very active in fighting the mine. One of the biggest gigantic hordes of wealthy, of useful minerals in our nation up there in Alaska. Right here in the Southwest, though, and I wrote a piece for National Review a couple weeks ago about the Resolution Mine in Arizona, which is this deep underground, just giant chunk of copper, and we are going to need a heck of a lot more copper if we're going to shift over to the electrified world that Martin Heinrich and all of his buddies are so in love with. But we're going to move on to a bunch of other issues, but I just wanted to pick Larry's brain a little bit finally about this, and this ties in right to the minerals issues, which is batteries. Another way in which the greenies come back at those of us who criticize their utopia is that, well, we're just going to build storage systems like batteries, or we're going to have pump storage where they actually pump water up on a hill or a mountain, and then of course the turbine will, water or hydro turbine will create it, and when they flow it down and then pump it back up again. I wrote something on my personal website about this a couple weeks ago. The reaction was much bigger than I thought. People were really not aware. They were grateful for me bringing this information to them about how much money the federal government, state governments now are flowing to energy storage. They'll say it's energy storage, and boy, it sounds really interesting. But Larry, energy storage with all these subsidies going to these companies, it's basic. This so Potemkin industry really wouldn't exist if we just stuck with our reliable energy sources. We wouldn't have to have the pump storage. We wouldn't have to have these huge battery farms, you know, out in the middle of nowhere, which have their own efficiency problems. So the energy storage issue is still budding, but I think that's our next boondoggle in the energy sphere.
Yeah, it absolutely is. And that process you're talking about with hydroelectric, I mean, good luck getting a dam built anywhere in the United States of America right now.
Even a little one. Yeah.
Yeah. If you're going to store the energy that, I mean, really seriously, good luck. It is something that every environmental group will sue you 6 ways till Sunday. And they've got friendly judges. They got friendly bureaucrats in Washington to do it. And when you talk about copper, you're talking about something near and dear to my heart. I grew up in Southwest New Mexico. It is Copper Central there. And my entire
Tyrone
town,
Mine, the Chino Mine. I've been down there. It's great. Great people down there.
Generations of my family work there, and you see what it is, a complete disconnect from what I've seen environmentalists do now for decades, which is fight that operation at every point, make it more expensive to pull that copper out of the ground and process it at every opportunity they can, because they're never upfront about what they want. They just want the mine closed down. They just want it to go away and not be there. But to your point, you don't get your solar panels without copper. You do not get your electric vehicles without copper. And so it goes into the, you know, I call it the nauseating, you know, I call it something I can't remember the name of right now. It is, you know, the nauseating hypocrisy of what they want when it comes to their energy. They're perfectly fine with the mine being run by slaves in China. They're perfectly fine with the mines being run by children in Africa. But heaven forbid an American worker have a job, an American worker who does it cleaner, better, and more legally than any other worker on the face of the planet. And so it seems like it is not really about the environment, because they seem to be okay with these processes as long as they take place further and further away. And oh, by the way, that's also true of their pet energy, right? How many folks saw that, you know, they don't want the windmills off the coast of Martha's Vineyard. They don't want the solar panels over their really great land. But it is really interesting to see how they're more than willing to, you know, use states like New Mexico, anywhere in the Southwest with a lot of space, as a sacrifice zone for their own little energy needs. It is all about who is getting paid with their groups and where that money is flowing to certain politicians, because it is definitely not in the best interest of the people or the land.
Yeah, it's funny, in our paper we published, A Bright Shining Disappointment, late last year. We actually did a version of that for National Review as well. I outlined a number of examples, Colorado, New Mexico, Nevada. There's some very affluent people, let's say, of a certain demographic group who think a certain way and probably vote a certain way. And boy, when the utility scale solar facility comes to their town or their county, they're not big fans of it anymore. It's always, you know, somebody else's problem. We are good for the second half of our show today, folks, on oil and gas, but electricity more specifically. We're going to wrap things up with this issue of electric cars. Now, interesting article ran in the Center Square, centersquare.com, interesting media outlet. They do some good work there. Something I've been looking at for a while, and I do think, provided we get rid of the gasoline tax, we don't retain the gasoline tax and then add a vehicle mile tax, if we're going to be, some people use natural gas to run their vehicles, some people use biodiesel. It seems to me a vehicle mile tax makes a lot more sense because it's neutral in terms of the fuel. As more people buy electric cars, states are starting to look into some kind of charges, because while those cars don't fill up on gasoline, so they don't pay the gasoline tax, but they still put wear and tear on the road. So a number of states, Tennessee, outside of our area, but within our area, Texas, our beloved Texas, just passed, and the governor just signed a $400 registration fee for a new electric vehicle, $200 to renew the registration for those electric vehicles that so many of our lefty friends run. I'm interested, Larry, in your thoughts on that. Maybe folks on the left would call it equity. If you're going to drive on the roads, regardless of what type of fuel you use, you do put wear and tear on our vital infrastructure. So where do you, your thoughts about fees for electric cars?
Yeah, well, I love them. It is more fair. And let's just be honest, what that has done in the past, you know, that's usually a tax that goes to, just be upfront, like it goes to truckers, right? They are heavier and on the road more. And so how the states, generally speaking, have separated that in the past, they've looked at it by axles. If your vehicle, either the one you're driving or the one you're towing, we're going to kind of charge you by axles for these fees and these things going on. And so with the assumption that a vehicle vehicle with many axles weighs more than a vehicle with fewer axles, which was largely true when it was all internal combustion. But if you have a two-axle EV versus a two-axle internal combustion car, the EV is going to weigh so much more. And it is the weight that really concerns people that build highways as far as wear and tear is concerned. The heavier the thing on the road, the more that that road is going to get tore up. Therefore, they charge those heavier vehicles more. And so it is great to see that in Texas, and it's also highly interesting to see the reaction from that. You know, I think it was a University of Texas professor that responded to it and said, well, this is not going to help with adoption of electric vehicles. Well, it is fascinating to see from the pay their fair share crowd over years and years. And let's be honest, studies have shown that the average owner of an electric vehicle makes $150,000 a year. And so when we talk about paying fair share for our roads, and yet they start to bulk at just $200 more a year for their registration because their car literally weighs a whole lot more than an internal combustion car and will tear up the roads more than that internal combustion car, you start to realize it wasn't really about them concerned about the environment. It's about them, you know, trying to bring up their prestige, but not having to pay the price for the things that we all use. You know, the pay your fair share crowd gets awful quiet when it comes time for the money out of their pocketbook.
Indeed, I think there's an option in the Massachusetts, the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, where you can pay a higher income tax at the state level, and you can check a box and pay that. Mm-hmm. And a very, very less than 1%, I think, last time I checked, of all those liberals up in
Massachusetts. I'm sure John Kerry checks it.
Oh, we're going to get to John Kerry. Oh, goodness. Folks, you are watching SBPI TV. We're here with Larry Behrens from Power of the Future, and thank you for tuning in. If you want to weigh in, if you've got a question or a comment, as long as you keep it clean, and we have a very clean audience, there's an option, whatever platform you're watching on, to just interact with us. So we'd certainly take your comments and questions. We're going to shift things over to get a little bit away from electricity and go more toward the oil and gas sector. And I think I'm going to tease you on this. Maybe another 10 minutes or so before we get to John Kerry. But a point that again, the Energy Information Administration, not my data. This was released by them on May 18th. 2023, Today in Energy. It's actually a really good site. They post data every day on this blog called Today in Energy from the U.S. Energy Information Administration. May 18th, Texas and New Mexico led U.S. crude oil production in 2022. Crude oil production in our great land, the land of the free, it grew 5.6%, about the equivalent of 600,000 barrels per day in 2022 compared with 2021. The two states in the Permian Basin, that would be Texas and New Mexico, because geology doesn't care about political jurisdictions, it sprawls across Texas and New Mexico. And I'd say for the sake of New Mexico, it's a very, very good thing, because God only knows what our taxes in New Mexico would be like if we didn't have the Permian Basin. This two-state region, this basin, contributed the most growth to our oil production in 2022. The Permian Basin, a productive, wildly productive oil basin located on the border of West Texas and eastern New Mexico. And I might add, the Midland newspaper this week, and we tweeted it out, was celebrating the 100th anniversary of the first oil well drilled down there in the Permian. So we just had a really important, again, on history, a century. And New Mexico, up in the San Juan County up there back in 2021, nobody in our state noted the 100th anniversary of the first commercial natural gas well. So tells you a little bit about how aware they are of their vital mineral interests in Texas versus New Mexico. But again, going back to the Energy Information Administration, the Permian Basin sprawls across both two states. Lead oil production in the country in 2022, for the third consecutive year, crude oil production grew more in New Mexico than in any other state. New Mexico production grew by 0.3 million barrels a day to 1.6 million barrels a day. That's a record for New Mexico. And we are a regional organization, and oil is produced in Texas and New Mexico and Colorado and even a little bit in Utah. It's on its way out. Larry, talk about New Mexico being a very blue state, Texas being holding on to its red status. A lot of folks really don't understand how much their tax burden is lightened in states that have severance taxes for booming oil sectors. You may be living in your suburb and going to your job at the office park. You may live in one of our southwestern states and never even see an oil well. But my Lord, does that industry benefit you indirectly?
Yeah, and I'll you know, I'll just put it in larger terms as well. And I, this goes to, if we're talking about New Mexico, but it can also be applied to Texas and Austin. If you live in Austin, you live in Albuquerque, you live in Santa Fe, you live in Flagstaff, you live in Boulder, Colorado, you have what I call a luxury of detachment. You have the benefit of everything that the energy industry does for you. You've probably lived your whole life, just like I have, where you flip the switch and absent a storm outside, the light has come on for your whole life. And so you feel, well, it'll just be perfectly fine if we get rid of an oil well and exchange that for a windmill, because, you know, light has always come on my whole life, and it'll keep coming on. And we have the opportunity to take it for granted because it is so omnipresent, but it is not an accident that it's there. You know, just like people sometimes aren't as aware where their food comes from or where their water comes from, they're definitely not aware from where their energy comes from, in particular the oil and gas. And so when you see folks in those urban areas decide that, you know what, we're going to dictate to folks in the rural areas that are producing this largesse for us, we're going to dictate to them how to live their lives, then yeah, there's going to be some absolute pushback on that. But when you see, you know, first of all, I'm heartened always to see production up in New Mexico, and definitely always heartened to see it up in the United States. But sadly, as we look at production in the United States, we were at about a 13 million barrel per month or per day production in November 2019. So we're talking pre-pandemic, and we have not gotten near or not reached that point yet. You know, the Biden administration says that they'll get there. Okay, great. But they're still throwing moratoriums on places where you can develop oil and natural gas. And so when, you know, again, it's looking to history. I'm old enough to remember presidential debates, Republicans and Democrats alike, lamenting that we could not be energy independent, that we had to assert ourselves in foreign policy in difficult geopolitical situations, and yes, in wars, because this critical need for energy that our nation has. Well, now we don't have to worry about that as much, because we have found a way to develop the energy within our borders and to keep us strong and to also help out our allies, and we are just willing to throw it away for political reasons. It doesn't make sense really to any American, and they all have, you know, long memories. And when I say long memories, they remember 3-4 years ago, the price of gas. They remember 3-4 years ago, we were being energy independent. And they contrast it with the actions taken in the political realm and the consequences of those actions that we're witnessing now. The highest gas prices we've ever seen, the highest inflation since, you know, Empire Strikes Back was in the movie theater. And so it is very real consequences when you start messing with these switches. And so I'm always glad to hear that production is up in New Mexico and Texas, anywhere in the United States. I'm always glad to hear that. But it bothers me that we've seen an administration that has gone to Saudi Arabia, that has gone to Venezuela, and said, will you guys please bring more oil to the market? And oh, by the way, the environmental groups that whine about production in New Mexico and whine about production in Texas were silent when Joe Biden went and begged Saudi Arabia and Venezuela for more gasoline, as if it seems like they don't care if oil and gas is extracted from the ground, just as long as it's not extracted in the United States. The people that tell us they care about the planet are more than happy to have that process done in the Middle East. And you have to start asking yourself, is this about the planet for them, or is it about political power within our borders? Well, any rational person will figure out that answer very quickly.
Well, it's interesting, the contrast. A couple months ago, I wrote a column about what was going on in California, Larry, where luxury environmentalism is not just rampant, it's completely out of control. Yep. Gavin Newsom signed a bill, the California Air Resources Board has adopted a, quote, roadmap so that by 2035, that's a dozen years from now, 100% of new cars and light trucks sold in the state will be zero emission vehicles. Newsom signed a bill forbidding new oil and gas wells or major retrofitting of existing wells, production wells, 3,200 feet between all these, you know, various places, the hospitals and nursing homes. But, you know, we in the West often know that you can live near and you can do business near wells. I believe it. Beverly Hills High had a operating oil well for a number of decades. California versus New Mexico, both states, people don't think of California anymore as a big oil producing state. If you want to go back to Larry's Empire Strikes Back, I was looking at data a couple months ago. I mean, California was the third largest oil producing state in the country back when Darth Vader told his son who he was. Third, California's dropped to seven with the regulatory assault, the legislative assault. I mean, California is on its way to destroy its oil and gas industry. They're making a conscious decision. Larry, here where I am, New Mexico, it's almost as if there are the political forces here. You know, New Mexico is pretty much as blue as California, maybe not quite as bad, but very close. The political forces here know they need that oil and gas money because they want to spend. They want, you know, pre-K to PhD, free education, free meals at school, regardless of whether mom and dad have any money or not, on and on and on, and free junior college, on and on and on and on and on. And it's there's an interesting contrast there, isn't there, here in the Southwest. You've got both blue states, both do not like their oil and gas industry, but you've got California actively, openly, blatantly saying we're going to destroy this industry, whereas New Mexico, they're a little more reticent because they know, I suspect, Larry, they know that that's where the bread is buttered revenue-wise, and they really love spending that money. So an interesting contrast between those two states.
Yeah, I've heard it described as a trust fund baby, right? You have this kid who's probably, you know, maybe third or fourth generation rich kiddo, and they don't like how grandma and grandpa, you know, made all those billions and zillions, and they rail against it every day because they don't have a job, because they don't have to work because they're so rich. But yet when that check shows up, they sure run down to the mailbox for it, right? And it's the same way with, you know, eco left politicians and the oil and natural gas industry. And it goes to the contrast we were talking about earlier with electricity. So we are going to 30% massively subsidize solar and wind. What's the revenue in terms of into the state coffers from that? It's next to none compared to what comes in from oil and natural gas. And California is the poster child for it. Let's just be upfront about it. They have gone further down this road than any other state, and now they're paying for it. You have the highest gasoline rates in the nation. You have some of the highest electrical rates in the nation. California imports more of their electricity, 25%, than any other nation or any other state in the country. And they get it from places like Arizona, Nevada, and New Mexico, and they pay a premium for it. But as those other states start to adopt California-like policies, I'm really worried that there won't be enough energy to sell back to California so that they can, you know, keep charging the Teslas when they want to, you know. And that's what we've really seen, that California's energy policy has been sadly copied as opposed to what it should be, shunned for the results that it's turned out. And not once from all the blackouts in California has the governor's mansion been blacked out. Silicon Valley always seems to keep the lights on. It is working class families, their neighborhoods, their areas, their cities that get affected the most by these things. They are paying a premium price to have unreliable electricity. And that seems to be a policy that a lot of governors, including the governor of New Mexico, governor of Colorado, a lot of them want to import. And it is not it's really interesting. If it was in the sports world, you know, it seems like everyone's looking at the Houston Texans and saying, well, that's the kind of team we want. That's the worst team around, and you want to copy it. And that's yet what we're doing with our energy policy in the United States.
Yeah, and
I'm a Texans fan, by the way. It hurts to say that.
Oh my. We won't say anything about Tom Brady and the Patriots. I do think I remember hearing at some point, and I don't know if Patrick knows or Larry knows, but I think the governor of California, the father, I think he didn't grow up with his father, but his bio dad was something like the legal counsel for Getty Oil. You know, he says I was raised by a single mother, but you know, but half of the parent unit was like some big legal executive for Getty Oil. So that might explain maybe some of Gavin Newsom's issues. But there's a great bill, Larry. I don't know if you know about it, because I just saw a headline. I scanned it really quickly a couple of weeks ago. There's a bill in the legislature, state legislature in Sacramento, where it has no chance of passing. But I think it's Assemblywoman from Kern County, oil country in California, and it was requesting a study for the environmental impact of all the oil that's going to be imported into California from foreign countries, as the lefties and rich lefties in California sort of preen themselves about destroying the oil and gas industry. And they'll be purchasing oil for their products, whether if it's not for fuel, they'll still be using it for other things. And it was looking at, you know, Venezuela and all these other countries that the oil will be imported from and what their environmental record is. So again, it's another disconnect. It's a cognitive dissonance with these people that I will never get to. I will never be able to plumb the depths of how bizarre that is. But speaking of spoiled babies.
I would just add too, you know, if I'm Gavin Newsom and I have great hair like Gavin Newsom does, there's no way I'm accomplishing that great hair. Absolutely. With all that oil.
Listen, but whatever you say about the guy, he's a damn good looking man.
And it gets
he'll be
to,
a terrible president, I suspect, when he is president eventually. But yeah.
Well, and it gets to are these arbitrary dates they throw out. You know, we're going to do this by 2030. We're going to do this by 2045. And no, not one single reporter asks him why that date. Why that many percentage of cars by why that date? And there's never any, it is literally arbitrary, but it always meets two categories. One, it's always in the future where this current politician will not be running for this office, right? That politician will be out of that office by then. And two, it's something that is just far enough out of the future to where, you know, sometimes we all have that goldfish memory that we forget of, oh yeah, it was supposed to be this much by now. And they never have to be accountable for the failures of it. But when we look at all these edicts being thrown out with all these dates attached to them, not one single member of the media will ask them why that date.
Mm-hmm. And I think extending, we're discussing energy today, folks, but always be wary of those arbitrary date settings. It's bizarre. They'll say by a certain year, we'll have high quality preschool available for every child in our state. By a certain year, we'll have a 100% graduation rate. These are not people moored in reality. Some of us understand that life can be difficult and utopian dreams cannot be just achieved by legislative fiat. Speaking of spoiled babies and traveling on planes, private planes, John Kerry, former senator from the great state of Massachusetts, talking a lot about Massachusetts today. I remember after he lost the presidency, George W. Bush was reelected in 2004. I'm a big fan of the talk show host Howie Carr out of Boston, Howie's a bit of an intellectual mentor of mine, kind of more of a street fighter than a researcher. But he kept playing the quote that John Kerry said, "Well, what are you gonna do after now that the election's over? Maybe some private sector stuff." No, he went to work for Barack Obama, and now he's working for Joe Biden. Nobody in the private sector. John Kerry doesn't bring anything to the table to help the private sector where there's actual accountability and you have to answer to shareholders. John Kerry is the climate czar, Larry, for the Biden administration.
Yeah.
John Kerry, speaking of people who make predictions that don't come true, he's right up there with Al Gore and James Hansen and, you know, all those crazy paranoiacs. John Kerry is flying all over the world to lecture people about their carbon footprint, Larry. A little hypocrisy there?
Well, of course it's hypocrisy, and every American knows it. And it would be laughable if the consequences, you know, weren't so serious. And so, and we found out this week, especially with John Kerry, how serious those consequences could be. You know, there was a Freedom of Information request that finally came to light. I think it was Real Clear Investigations.
Yep.
That
yep.
finally took a look at that office that John Kerry is running. You're right. He's the climate czar for Joe Biden, has been since day one. He works out of the State Department, so former Secretary of State, works out of the State Department to, you know, advance the climate goals through the State Department. But he's never been upfront about how many people work in his office. He has never disclosed his emails. He has never disclosed the budget. He's never disclosed any of that. And finally, it took a Freedom of Information request, you know, well over 2 years since Biden's been in office to get an idea. And it looks like it's up to 45 people work in his climate office. You and I and every other American pay that office $16.5 million in 2022 so that he could run around and tell us those things. And so as we look at the actions that are taken in the Biden administration, they come after your gas stoves. Yes, I don't care what newspapers are saying that it's not really happening. Look no further than New York. It is actually happening. They come after other appliances. They have these other rules and edicts that never get near Congress because they know they wouldn't pass in Congress. It's essentially the implementation of the Green New Deal through fiat. And you have to ask yourself, is this coming from this secret EPA that John Kerry is running out of the Department of State? Just this week, we saw the West Virginia governor, his family has tied to coal. He's been upfront about that. And lo and behold, the Department of Justice comes after his family this week, not even a month after he announced it, his candidacy for Senate against Joe Manchin. The Department of Justice then decides, oh, we're going to go after this guy. So they're weaponizing the Department of Justice. You know, we know that Secretary Deb Haaland has now taken Chaco Canyon drilling off the block for the next 20 years. Again, no one will ask her why, if it's so important and so sacred, to join and protect it for 20 years. No one will ask that question. But we have to see, you know, are all these edicts coming out of John Kerry's office? And is this, you know, the guy who's really pulling the strings for the radical environmental decisions coming out of Washington? Well, we would talk to him, but, you know, he's usually on a private plane overseas, which he has said he has to do because he is, his words, among the special people.
Yes, yes. Some of them even talk about how they've evolved beyond we mere slugs and worms who still consume oil and gas. They're evolved beyond that. They have a planetary consciousness in the way that the rest of us down in the filth and the mud we just can't relate to people like that. But Larry, I know Power of the Future is focused on the United States, but it seems to me, and I wrote about this not too long ago, and it was very easy to find examples of Vietnam and Malaysia and India and China, despite what they may say at international meetings, they're still importing more natural gas and building coal plants, you know, sticking with reliable fuel that we know how to use efficiently. We also have good pollution controls for these technologies as well. And these third world countries want a first world life, and who can blame them? It seems to me that as Kerry continues to fly, and all of his buddies continue to fly, and everybody meets at Davos, and they all go skiing in Gstaad. But boy, if you're in Moab or Taos or Aspen, and you're carbon neutral in your household, or if you're passing edicts at the county level or the statewide level, whatever gains you're making in carbon, boy, they are being more than offset by developing nations that want to have reliable power. And again, who could possibly blame these people? It's, I think, sadistic the way international liberal elites want these people to have the lowest quality energy technology and the lowest quality fuels. What's your take internationally? As awful as this, you know, Davos nonsense, Green New Deal reset is, and it's not a conspiracy because they're very open about what they want to achieve. Just read their own publications. It's not, you know, I'm not a Q guy. Sorry. It's just taking them at their word. It seems to me there's a lot of brave people in the developing world, even political leadership, and activists and business owners who are not buying into this. They may hold it out as an ideal. Maybe that's something we can get to later. We can worry about our carbon, but we still have millions of suffering people with disease and poverty, and, you know, sewers running through the street when you walk out of your hut. It just seems to me that as awful as John Kerry is, and I don't want to minimize the damage he's done, there's still a lot of brave people in the third world who are resisting his nonsense.
Well, not just resisting. I mean, you're exactly right, and I you know, forgive me, I don't remember the exact date, but I'm pretty sure it was last year, and I know it was in the Wall Street Journal, and I don't think it was the Nigerian president, but I do think it was an official from Nigeria who put in an op-ed that essentially it was showing that it was breeding resentment among, particularly in Africa, and you know, I'm paraphrasing here, but it essentially said, you have built your nation and you have built the world, the first world, off of fossil fuels, and now you are going to reach into our nation and reach into our countries and tell us that we cannot do the same. It is it builds resentment that they not only, you know, to your point, they never travel to like Dupree, South Dakota. They are always in these very exclusive cities and resorts while they lecture the rest of us. And these countries are getting really angry when they say, how dare you try to tell me how I'm going to build up my society? You have sold us on, you know, having refrigerators, having air conditioning, having running water, and all these things that most of the world doesn't have, that, you know, we have built here in the United States and in many first world countries, and we are going to deny them the opportunity to do the same. And to boot, you know, I think it was when they met in Egypt last year, they said, oh, don't worry, we're going to start paying the climate reparations. It's essentially hush money, is it not? You know, take aside the fact the United States never voted as a country to decide if we're going to start paying other countries to not get on fossil fuels. So we'll send them a check, and that's supposed to make everything okay. That is the constant refrain from the left. We saw it in New Mexico when they closed down a power plant. It's like, oh, well, we've put a bunch of money aside so for those workers. And so, yeah, we may have taken your job, your livelihood, and the thing that your family's done for generations, but we'll cut you a check. And that is the attitude that we see from the environmental left. As long as we can cut you a check at some point, it absolves us of any of that issue. Well, there are a lot of countries, not only in Southeast Asia, but yes, in Africa, saying, no, it doesn't absolve you. We are going to plot our own energy path. We're not going to listen to, you know, your way of doing things, because we see the hypocrisy of you're telling us to skip this step of the Industrial Revolution and skip this step of building out an infrastructure for this other step that is not reliable for our country. And they know it. And so it is really interesting to see the resentment it is starting to build from those developing nations. I mean, Alex Epstein does a great job arguing a lot of this. You know, if you look at the number of people in the world that has electricity, it is a minority compared to the number of people who don't have it. And those that don't have it are going to want it, and we're going to have to generate it. And so to tell them all these things that have generated it for us are now off the table for them, it is going to be a problem.
Yeah, and I'm glad. I think the other element of the green hypocrisy on this for a low carbon footprint, we're really running super low on time. But just a couple words, Larry, about nuclear. Now, Georgia Power has just started up operation at Unit 3 of its new nuclear plant. We are nuclear reactor. They issued a press release a couple days about that. We have struggled to revive nuclear in our country, but certainly globally, and I dare say even here in the United States, we did a program on this a little bit a couple weeks ago about there's more and more interest in nuclear, which is, of course, no carbon emissions. And also, given the fact that if you're concerned, you know, we have our pro-Zelensky, pro-Ukraine virtue signalers out there, we could revive our own uranium industry here in the United States because we have plenty of it, particularly here in the American Southwest. Do you think nuclear should play a role here in America, but and also the interest that's popping up globally? But let's not bash the environment. Let's just look at the issue itself. Where does Power of the Future, what is Power of the Future thinking about in terms of the future of nuclear?
It's really simple. We believe that the citizens should choose what is best, most affordable, and reliable for them. We know that that's what Americans want. They want electricity that is first reliable, second affordable, and solar and wind are neither. If nuclear is in that mix and the people choose that and say that's what we want, then that's fine. But you know, when you look at nuclear, you have to also just look at that in the lens of how it highlights the lie of the environmental left, right? They tell us they want that the earth is dying, that we only have so many years to act, and we have to go carbon neutral. And you mentioned the word nuclear, which checks all those boxes, and yet they can't tolerate it there. In New Mexico, they fought to get, you know, the nuclear power that New Mexico did get from Arizona. They fought to get that taken out of the portfolio, even though it checks all the boxes that they tell us they want. It is, you know, nuclear is really a strong point for showing them that, you know what you say you want is just a lie, because here is something that checks all those boxes and you just can't tolerate it.
Sure. We're going to kick things back to Patrick in 1 second. I just want to get Larry's, if I get about 25 seconds from Larry on an issue of more local here in New Mexico, the Chaco Canyon site, ancient site, and it's important to preserve history. We had an announcement from the Department of Interior run by a certain politician who originated in the land of enchantment. What was that development today, Larry? And what does the Navajo Nation think about restricting oil and gas to an excessive degree that is not posing a risk to this admittedly wonderful site?
Yeah, it's a perfect example of top-down environmentalism, is it not? You know, you have here a local population, including tribal government, that says this is what we want. We would like it this way. We live here. We benefit from these industries. We know how they work. And then next thing you know, the federal government says, no, we know better. And they come in and they say, we're doing it to protect the sacred and environmental nature of this land. Well, first of all, there's plenty of common sense points on the land. But secondly, why just 20 years then? It absolutely makes no sense at all. It is a, you know, Deb Haaland has never met a gas moratorium that she doesn't like.
Yes, there's a lot of problems with Deb Haaland that we could spend the next hour on Deb Haaland, ladies and gentlemen, and things that probably would get us sued. So I'm going to just shut up right now and kick it over to the president and the founder of the Southwest Public Policy Institute, Patrick. I'm sorry if I've been a little too monopolistic on our program today, but once you get Larry and I going, it's really hard to stop us.
I know. I had to message you like, Dad, pay attention to me, please.
Cut it off.
I can't send those video cues to you. Got a text to you. So anyway, Larry, thank you so much for joining us today. This was SPPI TV episode 11, Powering the Future. We really appreciate you taking the time to come chat with us. And that'll conclude our conversation with Larry. The energy work of the Southwest Public Policy Institute is ongoing. We're continuing it. I think that we really kicked it off, Dowd, last year in the spring when the Institute ran its energy poll, its energy survey. We sent the survey invitation to over 300,000 New Mexicans. 3,000 New Mexicans responded. And one of the first questions that we ask on the survey is, which of the following is most important to you? Reliable energy, affordable energy, or green energy when it comes to energy production? And we only allowed the respondents to choose one of those things. Now, 7 out of 10 New Mexicans chose affordable and reliable energy over green energy, which begs the question, why are states like New Mexico importing California-esque energy policy when it's not the desires of the constituency? Why, again, we have an administration that is ignoring the constituency, and that's what makes us so much better, because we're letting the constituency drive our policy initiatives. What does the constituency actually want? Anyway, Dowd, thank you so much for hosting today's episode of SPPI TV. Ladies and gentlemen, you can find out more about the Southwest Public Policy Institute at southwestpolicy.com. You can help us keep these events free by making a contribution to the Institute at donate.southwestpolicy.com. The Institute is a 501c3 nonprofit charitable organization. Donations to the Institute are tax deductible. Ladies and gentlemen, it was SPPI TV episode 11. Join us every Friday at 1 p.m. Mountain Time as we go live on Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, YouTube, and later on, we'll be disseminating the podcast via all the traditional podcasting services, from Apple Music to Stitcher to what are the other ones? Spotify, Google Podcasts, everything, all of the above. You can find out more about the Institute at southwestpolicy.com. Help us keep these events free. I'm going to make that plug again. You can make a tax-deductible donation to the Institute at donate.southwestpolicy.com. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen, for tuning in today, and we'll see you next week.